For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. The New York Times is reporting that the Iraqi government, such as it is almost finished with negotiations on a new oil law, which will nationalize the oil and divide up the proceeds from it evenly among the different ethnicities. This has been a major sticking point, one of the reasons why the Sunnis have refused to accept the majority rule of the Shia, is they don't live on oil land. It's all in the north and the south. And this new oil law is going to go a long way towards solving that problem. At least that's the way the New York Times has it. But for a little bit of background, help us understand what's really going on with Iraqi oil, I have on the phone investigative reporter Greg Pallast. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. He also writes for The Guardian and does BBC Newsnight. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Hey, glad to be with you, Scott. Don't believe the baloney at all.
I shouldn't believe it, huh?
It's not the plan for dividing up Iraq's oil and the program for Iraq's oil was not written in Iraq, and it's not to make sure that there's no civil war there. It was written in the capital of America, in Houston, Texas. That is, it was written by the oil industry under the watchful eye of the functional president of the United States, a guy named James Baker.
And when was it written? This is part of the
recent
Baker plan?
Okay, now here's the interesting thing. Everyone knows about the great Baker report that was going to save us, though it's kind of been forgotten while Bush has the urge to surge. Until then, everyone was saying, thank God a grown-up James Baker has been called in to save us in Iraq. Well, let me tell you something. Baker has been the grise eminence, has actually had an office in the White House. Which is very rare. Even Dick Cheney's office isn't in the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Baker's had an office in the White House since 2003 to deal with Iraq and basically pull the strings.
He was the guy in charge of restructuring the debt.
Right. Now, technically, the guise was he's restructuring Iraq's debt. But unless I last looked, it's sovereign debt. George Bush is not the sovereign of Iraq. Okay, so they were messing not only with Iraq's debt, but secretly, they didn't tell you, and this is one of the stories in our madhouse, is that James Baker's crew out of Houston, oil company executives, wrote up a 323-page plan for the oil fields of Iraq. And it involved, the whole point of that plan was to, quote, enhance Iraq's relationship with OPEC.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and what that means is, the point was, is that there was a great fear that the neocons were going to use Iraq, that they were going to privatize oil fields, ramp up production, bring down the price of oil, and thereby bring Saudi Arabia and OPEC to its knees. That was the geopolitical game plan of the neocons. But that didn't work because there are neocons who look to be very powerful in Washington because they get to go, they write all the op-eds and they go on the Sunday morning TV shows. But that's not what's powerful in Washington. Op-eds aren't powerful in Washington. Oil is.
Well,
and James Baker represents ExxonMobil Oil, most of the oil companies, and he also represents the government of Saudi Arabia. And his team moved in and said the neocon plan is just forget it, guys. What we're going to have is a state-owned oil company which will adhere to the OPEC quotas, keep production down in Iraq, keep the price of oil up, and that is a key matter which came out in the Baker plan. One thing that wasn't discussed, everyone talked about troop levels. The big hunk of the Baker plan was about what to do with the oil fields of Iraq, which was his secret plan, which he now made public in 2006, was the secret plan that they drafted in 2004, which I have a copy of, by the way, and we now see the public version of it in 2006 as the Baker plan. And within a week of Baker and his oil boys drafting the plan, it was adopted by Iraq, not that they had much choice. And so the Iraq plan is about saving OPEC, saving Saudi Arabia, maintaining a high price of oil, and saving ExxonMobil and buddies so that oil profits stay high. That's what that plan is about. They don't care if there is endless blood in the streets of Baghdad. That is, the division there has nothing to do with ending the civil war whatsoever. Nothing. Zero.
Well, you write in your book that Baker actually was on board. The original plan was the Baker Institute Council on Foreign Relations plan that, correct me if I'm wrong, was basically to do a coup d'etat in Iraq and replace Saddam with, you say, the next mustache in line, meaning the next Sunni general, the next Ba'athist general.
That's right.
That they could put in power.
Originally, you should, you know, for those who haven't read my book, and shame on you if you haven't read Our Men Out. But originally, we discovered that there were secret meetings of the Council on Foreign Relations and the James Baker Institute to discuss the world oil future. Not just, you have to understand, it wasn't just Iraq, but it was the entire world oil future. And by the way, that also explains the meetings with Dick Cheney, because part of that committee, a guy on that committee was Ken Lay. That was the committee. This Council on Foreign Relations, James Baker crew, is the one that had the secret meeting in the bunker with Dick Cheney to go over the oil maps of Iraq. Okay,
the stuff that they still won't release.
They won't release it, but now I know what happened there.
And how do you know what happened?
I talked to people who were in it.
Oh, okay.
Okay, now, so that explained this weird thing where a guy like Ken Lay is talking about Iraq's oil with Dick Cheney, because Lay was on the Baker Council on Foreign Relations little committee.
Yeah, but Cheney didn't go with the CFR Baker plan. He went with the neocon plan.
So then what happened was that Baker, obviously, it was presented to Cheney, but then after, this was before September 11th, remember. This is early on in the administration, within a month of the administration taking office. At that time, the State Department and the oil companies met in Walnut Creek, California, and devised a plan with the State Department. I hope your listeners are taking notes. They devised a plan with the State Department to have a coup d'etat, what they called an invasion disguised as a coup d'etat, in which you'd have an Iraqi general bump off Saddam, take control, invite, say, if he needed it, invite the 82nd Airborne in to protect the new democracy of Iraq. And like they've had before, the way that we supported the Saddam's takeover is that we just say, okay, there's a new guy there, recognized new government, nothing changes. And the only thing that would change is that you would now have back in power the guys in charge of Iraq that were always, that the oil companies were always comfortable with. Remember, Saddam was our butcher in Baghdad. We liked the guy, and he got along well with our oil companies. But then, after September 11th, the neocons did gain power. That's Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Pearl, and gang. And their idea was quite different. Instead of just an invasion coup d'etat combo where we're in and out, literally in 3 days, that was the original idea, 3 days in and out, that there would be a full-scale invasion and one-year occupation, which would allow for this remaking of Iraq into this kind of free market miracle. Everything would be privatized, including the oil fields, and ultimately it would be Saudi Arabia, which would be the ultimate target of the invasion of Iraq.
Right.
That
now,
was
these are
conceived
two
of at the Heritage Institute, by the way, by a guy, Ari Cohn, was the so-called brains behind it. And as one oil company executive, the ex-CEO of Shell Oil, said, the neocon plan, which was presented as a no-brainer, was clearly devised by someone with no brains.
Right.
And the CEO of Shell Oil personally, a guy named Phil Carroll, stepped in and said, this is not going to happen. And that was after the invasion. So now what's coming up is that the Baker boys, the oil companies, the Saudi interests, are standing up and becoming, are now taking charge of policy. And when you look at the Sunni-Shia conflict.
Well, Greg, let me stop you,
yeah,
though.
Okay, so let's stop there, because you got to digest just that.
Yeah, yeah, let's talk about, let's go back to the original split over the invasion plan. I think it's worth emphasizing. You're saying there's two very different motivations on one side, the neocons, and on the other side, the Baker guys. The neocons wanted to completely bankrupt Saudi Arabia by dropping the price of oil through the floor and destroying OPEC.
That's right.
And what Baker wanted was basically to empower the Saudis over Iraq so that OPEC would to keep the price high.
That's right.
Okay. Now, you're saying that the Baker guys are now coming to the forefront, and yet it seems to me that George Bush has told the Baker group to beat it.
Nah. First of all, it doesn't matter. Who's George Bush anyway?
Well, doesn't it matter?
I mean, come on. He's just a failed oil man.
Well, let me give you an example.
Warming the office next to James Baker's office. In fact, when I called the White House, because I did have a U.S. journalist say that they doubted that James Baker had an office in the White House. This was last year. And we called we actually called his office at the White House.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
Baker, and they put you right through.
That was reported,
So what's happened is that what I also found out is that they sometimes James Baker uses the Oval Office desk while the president plays on the rug.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, too.
I made that up. Let's not overdo the role of George Bush here in this operation.
Okay, right. Let's get to the neocons. Houston, we got Houston and New York on one side, and we have the neocons and some military-industrial complex-type businesses on the other side. These aren't just personality differences. There's a very serious policy difference here.
Huge policy difference. Billions of dollars on the table. You have to understand, the real fight is not between Sunni and Shia. The real fight is between big oil, Saudi Arabia, and OPEC, which obviously they want. There's two rules in the oil business. The first rule is the lower the supply, the higher the price. And the second rule is the lower the supply, the higher the price. You understand those two rules, you understand the entire oil industry. They want a low supply. They like berserkers, killings, insurgency, fires, bombings in Iraq. They love it.
Well, they'll settle for that if they can't get their Tin Pot Baptist dictator, right?
Yeah, if they can't get a guy who will simply turn off the spigots for them and reduce the output of his own nation to favor the oil companies and Saudi Arabia, then they'll have to do it by other means, and they don't mind the mayhem.
And you say in your book, that's been the policy since the 20s, right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I wrote about was that Iraq was the original kind of red... It was, we use the term redlining when we talk about people excluded from insurance or banking. The first use of redlining was to redline, literally, there was a red line drawn around a map of Iraq by oil company executives on the floor of a hotel room in Brussels in 1925, and they said no one drills within the red line, which included Syria, Iraq, and even at that time, parts of Saudi Arabia. No one drills there. We're going to keep oil off the market. And all the oil company executives literally signed their name on the red line, on the map, on the floor. And since then, the story of Iraq has been the story of how to keep Iraq from producing its oil. Because Iraq has known reserves of 100 billion barrels of oil. They only have developed 35 fields out of 125 fields, and everyone knows that they could easily increase their known, their provable reserves up to 200 billion, which begins to threaten Saudi hegemony. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to keep Iraq out of the oil market, minimize its role in the oil market, whether you do it through an oil for food program saying they can't produce more than 2 million barrels a day, you do it through an embargo in which you say they can't produce any oil, you do it through insurgencies, bombings, invasions, you do it through the power of OPEC setting quotas on the country. For 80 years, we've had nothing but a story of how to suppress oil production in Iraq to keep up the price of oil.
Now, on the other side, you have the neocons who say, let's produce every drop of Iraqi oil in order to destroy Saudi Arabia. Now, Greg, why would the neocons want to destroy Saudi Arabia?
Okay, the neocons, they have a whole different geopolitical viewpoint. Obviously, the neocons are close to, they see themselves as the great defenders of Israel. They see Saudi Arabia as the ultimate enemy and threat to Israel.
Even more so than Iran.
Well, yes, though I think that's beginning to that may be beginning to change, because once again, and you know, to understand what's going on here, you have this, a lot of the Shia Sunni split would be nothing. After all, there are religious factional nasty differences, sectarian differences all over the world. What is fueling this is oil. That is, Saudi Arabia backs the Sunnis, and Iran backs the Shia, and you are developing a kind of split in OPEC, which also has a religious tint to it. So we cannot move away, in other words, creating blocks. You have to understand, they have completely different interests, Iran and Saudi Arabia, in OPEC. Okay. Saudi Arabia, everyone in OPEC wants a high price, certainly so do the oil companies. But Saudi Arabia has also, now this is subtle, Saudi Arabia wants volatility in the oil market. Saudi Arabia likes the price of oil to shoot through the roof to $75 a barrel and then fall to the floor to $18 a barrel. And it's done that over the past three decades.
Up now, why do they do that? Why do they like it to be volatile?
You got a windmill? It becomes worthless the second oil drops below $30 or $25 a barrel. Every solar project, every alternative energy project, and now significantly tar sands of Canada, and really important, the heavy oil of Venezuela, is all pulled off the market, because that crap takes, you know, the crud from Canada and Venezuela, it costs $30 a barrel to produce, market, refine, and get out there. Solar,
so they have
power,
to produce,
et cetera, requires high value. So the idea is that the Saudis eliminate all competitors to Saudi light crude. So if you eliminate the competitors to Saudi light crude, you can keep cranking the price of oil up. Think about it this way. If you keep the price of oil up by classic economic theory, my old, and this was a point made by my late and gratefully dead mentor, Milton Friedman, is that if you keep the price up, all these alternative energies will come in, and then the price will slowly drift down, and drift down permanently once all these new sources come online.
Sure.
Saudi Arabia, as Sheikh Yamani, the head of OPEC, the former head of OPEC, once said, the Stone Age didn't end because people ran out of stones. And his point was that OPEC better watch how they deal with high prices, that you can't keep up high prices forever. Every 8-9 years, you have to drop the price to the floor, destroy the alternatives. Iran can't afford that. Venezuela can't afford that. And they are in a war with Saudi Arabia. And you can't look at Iraq without looking at this war over control of OPEC.
So the neocons are willing to destroy Saudi Arabia and OPEC and take the risk of then empowering Iran in that fight?
Well, remember that the original threat, you know, remember, not everything that they have is based on Israel. That's one of their, you know, pet projects, right? But their view is that Saudi Arabia is the ultimate threat, that they control policies of the U.S. government through guys like James Baker. They're the big, obviously, you know, we've seen that through influence of Bin Laden.
Well, I mean, who's Zoom and who? Who, I mean, really, is it not the case that America's the empire and Saudi Arabia is our client state?
No. We have, after all, who is, you know, it's not like George Bush was elected. who's calling the shots in Iraq? Is it George Bush, or is it the Saudi monarchy? Who is really calling the shots here? And so, I mean, you know, is there a real big difference at this moment? I don't know. I mean, House of
well,
Bush,
what
House
shots
of Saudi,
are they calling? What shots are the Saudis calling in Iraq, Greg?
That's the point. For example, who wrote the James Baker report? Here's a good example of how
power
works.
Greg, pardon me for a second. Just last night, I'm reading Edward Djerian from the James Baker Institute on the internet, fighting arguing vociferously against the neocons, Frederick Kagan, and the guys at the American Enterprise Institute that wrote up the Iraq Surge Plan. These guys are at war against each other, the Baker Group and the neocons. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me that the Surge and the neocon plan is really a front for the James Baker plan.
Yeah, it is. Okay, now let me explain. What happened over Thanksgiving? Dick Cheney, was told to drop his turkey and fly to Riyadh to go and kiss the throne of King Abdullah. Abdullah, we know, told him through the impolitic leak by Prince Al Turki and his spokesman Nawaf Obaid that Cheney was told, "You ain't pulling your troops out of Iraq, Jack." And everyone is reading the James Baker report upside down. Baker was not primarily recommending a reduction in half the troops. He was recommending keeping half the troops and keeping all of them there for 1 year. The surge is a pimple. It's a distraction. It's a nothing. Okay? It means zero nothing. You know, so you have a sop to some neocon fruitcakes. As remember that Bush has to keep and Cheney try to keep both sides on the perk. But when it comes down to it, why are we in Iraq? Because Saudi Arabia told us we can't leave. That's what it's all about. Whether we have 20,000 more or 20,000 less, of course, that's virtually insignificant in the scheme of things. Wonderful distraction so the Democratic Party can pretend it's being an opposition, and you have a bunch of Republicans who can jump off the bandwagon and not talk about the war, but just talk about the surge. You know, so you don't have any Republicans at all talking about the war. They just talk about
Well, that's not really true. Actually, you got Hagel, and there are quite a few guys in the House, Walter Jones and Ron Paul and others.
And you know what?
In fact, the anti-war Republicans are better than the Democrats, as far as I can tell.
Well, yeah, but they're not. They have zero influence on policy. I mean, no one cares what these guys think. Not that anyone cares what the Democrats think either. You have to understand, the Saudi Arabians said you are not pulling out of Iraq.
And now let's narrow that down for the audience. Why is that? It's because America has turned over Iraq to the Iran factions, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, and the Dawah Party. That's why, right? We've turned the country over to the Iranians.
Well, what happened was, under the neocon, you know, the neocons are not the brightest guy. You know, they're not the, you know, they're sharp as marbles.
We sure do agree about
that. They're
not
like the oil company. Okay, they think, okay, we're going to go in there and smash the power of Saudi Arabia through Iraq by de-bathifying the country and removing the Sunnis from power. Well, that left a place for Iran to move in, of course. And now the Sunnis, the so-called, first of all, the insurgency is a joke. You have to understand that where are they getting their money? And it's coming from Saudi Arabia.
And this is one of the real contradictions of this policy for anybody who has family over there serving in the military, that our soldiers are fighting the Sunni insurgency that they are there to protect from the Shiite majority that we've installed in power there.
Right. So what's happening now is that we have, and I feel terribly sorry for American troops because they're literally, the way it's being put finally is that our troops have been put in the middle of a civil war, and it's put in religious terms, like, and people think in terms of like Ireland, you know, Catholics versus Protestants or something. This is a wrong way of looking at it. The only way that these two factions, the Shia and the Sunni, have power is because they are funded by two fighting factions of the oil cartel OPEC. You've got Iran fighting at one end by supporting the Shia militias, and then you've got the Saudis supporting the so-called Sunni insurgency. But it's really a proxy war over control of OPEC. And in fact, what we saw, very interestingly, the so-called October surprise that occurred just before the midterm, which was to see a marked sudden drop in the price of oil, which did happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told by insiders in the oil industry was, while helping out, trying to help Bush in the midterms was part of the thinking, as everyone expected. But actually, the big issue for the Saudis was to kind of take a little wind out of the sails of Ahmadinejad and Hugo Chavez.
Uh-huh.
And
because we've been making them very powerful with this war and driving up the price the way we have, right?
Yes, we've turned we're turning Chavez into the Abdullah of the Americas. Because what's happening is, and by the way, you know, I mean, as Well, Chavez considers himself a good friend of mine. It's not mutual. That is, I don't make friends with politicians, period, of any type. I think it's dangerous for a journalist to do that. And I think he's done a terrific job as president of his nation, sharing the only oil president I know, and that includes George Bush, who is working hard to share the oil wealth of his nation with
his
people.
Well, tell me you don't approve, Greg, that he's now ruling by decree and nationalizing every industry he can get his hands on.
Well, I think it's an exaggeration. I mean, he's unlike our president, he was elected, and elected by a gigantic majority of the population, and he's acting as the people. He's actually doing something that doesn't happen much in America. He's carrying out his campaign promises, you know.
And he's doing so on inflated oil prices.
But he is, his authority and his popularity are based completely on the high price of oil.
Right.
Hugo Chavez is tremendous. I've been down to Venezuela many times, spoken with him, and spent a lot of time, by the way, with his opposition. His popularity is based on the high price of oil. He's wildly popular throughout Latin America, and in particular in his own country. But, you know, if the price of oil were $22 a barrel, Hugo Chavez would not be a popular guy. He wouldn't be elected dog catcher, okay? And he knows it, and I know it, and everyone knows it. Now, why is it that Dick Cheney just turned this guy into a powerful man? This goes back to this issue again of volatility. I know from inside the Department of Energy, we were able to get the documents showing that the Department of Energy itself feels that the largest oil fields and largest reserve of oil in the world is not in Saudi Arabia, but in Venezuela.
If the price is high enough.
If the price of oil is at least $40 a barrel. $35 to $40 a barrel. If oil stays above $35 a barrel, people have to understand when we talk about how much oil there is in the world, you have to say at what price.
Right.
Right. If at $18 a barrel, there ain't much oil in the world because not much oil that you can pull up at a price of $18 a barrel outside of Arabia. If you talk about $60 a barrel of oil, you got a ton of oil because you can melt tar sands, and even more important, you can melt the heavy tar oils of Venezuela. Venezuela has a big, giant pool of tar. 90% of the world's extra heavy oil, 90% is in Venezuela, 90%. And that reserve of oil is about five times the size of Saudi Arabia's reserve of oil. The difference is that it costs $30 to $40 a barrel to get Venezuelan tar into your SUV. It costs about $4 a barrel to get Saudi light crude into your SUV.
Right.
40 versus 4. So you can see the Saudi game. Mm-hmm. Crank the price up, make a lot of money, drop the price down below 40, and no one will invest in Hugo Chavez's oil. And by the way, when you say Chavez is nationalizing everything in sight, not the oil. He's very, very smart.
Well,
he's saying that Venezuela has technically owned 51% of any oil venture, which most oil companies other than the Italians and French have no problem with. And because he needs Exxon, even more important, he needs Shell Oil, and he needs ConocoPhillips to invest billions of dollars in pulling up that gunk he has in the Orinoco.
Right.
And that is Chavez's game, and that's why he's allied with Ahmadinejad. It has nothing to do with fighting U.S. imperialism. It has everything to do with their joint need to maintain a minimum price of oil.
Right. Very well spoken there. Now, we are almost out of time here, Greg,
right.
But we got to get to Ahmadinejad real quick. The neocons plan basically shortcuts the problem between Saudi Arabia and Iran by saying, let's bomb Iran and regime change Iran.
Right.
Do you think that's really on the horizon or a lot of tough talk?
Well, they don't call me. I have to usually investigate. You know, by the way, just so you know.
I know you're paying attention.
To get the oil plans, the secret oil plans out of that James Baker and his crew came up with, it was like 2 years of work on our staff and our chief investigator.
Quick, Iran, come on, hurry.
So I don't know if they're gonna get away with doing such a bombing game. Because
Baker wants to talk to him. Baker wants to talk to him. The neocons want to bomb him.
Well, that's simple then. Then we'll be talking.
Oh, good. I'm glad you feel that way. Everybody, Greg Palast, he's the author of Armed Madhouse. And also, before that, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Check out his website, gregpalast.com. Thanks very much, Greg.
Take it easy, Scott. Bye.